Thank you very much. I hope you like the title. The subtitle is a little bit cheeky. I just thought I'd put it in there to give you a little bit of contextualization before I start talking about sort of the meat of my research. So I'll be talking about the digital world, so digital text and what's out there, the sorts of things that are out there that are ripe for exploitation. Talk about meaning, because that's central to language. This is about computer processing of language. And then I'll talk about three areas of research that I've been involved in over the years, dating back to, I guess, well, my PhD and even before that to when I was an undergraduate and I did a final year project in this area, which really sort of kindled my interest, and I've been in the field ever since. So, as a scientist, I thought I'd, and well, particularly as an empiricist, I thought I'd better start with a graph. So here's a graph of total active websites from the year 2000 to now, to October 2010. So in 2000, there are about 10 million active websites. Now I think there are around 10 million, and now there are about 86 million. This could very well be quite wide of the mark. It's very difficult to count websites. But I think you get the general trend of this, and we all know that websites have got richer and richer over the years, more and more content, more depth, and perhaps there's about 25 billion pages online. But even that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there's the deep web, what's called the deep web, which consists of documents or web pages that you have to try harder to get at, so they're only accessible via a query interface, perhaps. And then organizational internal document repositories. So there's billions of documents, or perhaps more than billions. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's masses of stuff out there. And much of that information is in the form of text. There's also a lot, of course, as spoken audio, music, and images, but I'm particularly interested in the text and doing things with that text, doing useful things with it. There's an enormous diversity in that text, so different types of web pages, different types of documents in hundreds of languages, about different things, of different genres, so facts, opinion, entertainment type text, reportage in newspapers, for instance, and we want to retrieve it, we perhaps want to analyze it, get facts out of it, we want to synthesize the information in those documents and present it in a different way, perhaps we want to summarize documents, translate them to different languages, and so on and so on. And this is computational linguistics. It's about computer-based modeling and processing of human language. And it's sometimes called natural language as opposed to computer languages, which is what you program in, or what I program in. Probably not many of you, but I do. And this field has changed massively in the past few years. So all of this text that's come online and is available in machine-readable form as digital text, we have all of this data, and we have masses of computer power, much, much more than we could have imagined 10 or 20 years ago. And both of those two things have transformed research in this field, the way we do it and the techniques that we use. Okay, so that's a little bit about digital text, digital world. Also in the title is meaning. And I've got meaning in the title rather than understanding. I think it's going to be, well, probably never that we'll get computers to really understand language in the way that we do, in the way that humans do. They're fundamentally different from us, and there's all sorts of philosophical questions here about what it means to be a computer, what it means to be a human, and how different we are, and what we can do and what humans can do and how we interact with the real world. But I'm not going to go into that. I'm much more of a technologist, and I want to see what we can do with meaning rather than understanding, and just enough meaning that we can do useful things with it. I'm not trying to get full understanding. So here are a few examples of things that would be very difficult for a computer to deal with, so ambiguities in the language where probably humans wouldn't see any ambiguity at all, because we have real world context and we've got a linguistic context. So if we're reading a document, we know what that document is about, and that can disambiguate these tricky things. So here, I just came across this headline in a recent newspaper report, Scots Strikers in Fine Form. So strikers here is obviously football strikers. It's not going to be people who are workers who have down tools. And we know that. And we don't sort of have any second thought about that when we read that, but this would be incredibly difficult for a computer to deal with, knowing what type of strikers this is about. I'll just quickly do the second example. Without refrigeration, when a pig or cow is ready to eat, the whole village feasts. Well, it's obvious that the village is feasting on the pig or cow, but a computer wouldn't know that because pigs or cows can eat. And there's a reading of this sentence where the pig or cow is ready to eat, and the whole village rejoices because the pig or cow is ready to eat. And how does a computer know this? It's just a fact about the real world that it's much more likely that people eat these things than in a feast than the pig or cow eat in this context. And so on and so on. So meaning, and well, understanding is an incredibly tricky concept. What the trick is really in computational linguistics is to just go as far as we can into the meaning to actually do something useful. So we need to restrict the scope of the task that we're doing in clever ways such that we can actually compute the meaning and do sensible things, do useful things. And also, I think the second main trick in the area that we've come across, we've been enabled to do recently, is to use masses of statistical information about real language usage, because there's so much text out of there. So the second clever thing that we have to do is to work out how to use that information in the ways that will allow us to get over these ambiguities somehow. And I hope during the rest of the talk, the ways that we use this statistical information, or some of the ways, will become evident as I go through a few examples. I should point out that the study of language, or the processing of languages, is studied in other fields, other related fields. So, for instance, neuroscience, so that's a MRI scan of the brain. And if you're in a fMRI experiment and someone is saying words to you, then areas of that would light up because there'd be increased blood flow in the areas of the brain that relate to concepts that are elicited when you listen to various words that have been said to you. And that can give us good clues about how language is processed in the brain. In psycholinguistics, there are experiments where humans are presented with stimuli and they have to do something in response to those, and the speed at which they produce their response can tell you things about how difficult the processing is in the mind, in the brain, and the sorts of processing that's going on. And that's incredibly interesting as well, but those sorts of endeavours have yet to make a practical impact on computational processing of language. They're sort of, I think in a few years' time, maybe 10 or 15 years' time, they will, but not quite there yet. Okay, so my research. I use computers to do things with text and meaning. So try and bridge the gap between text and meaning and then do useful things with that meaning. So the tools, the three main tools I use are, well, computers, and I program. So there's a snippet of a bit of program. And as I said, computing resources are so much more powerful nowadays than they used to be. So we have server farms or compute servers, and you can run very large jobs in parallel on those. And that's absolutely necessary for some of the things I'm doing at the moment. Machine learning. So This is, the idea here is that you take data that often that's been annotated with the sorts of things that it represents, and you use that to learn a mapping between that data and the thing that you want to get out of it. So for instance, if we have documents which are about various topics, we can learn to classify other documents which are similar to those into the right sort of topic areas. And I'll give an example of that a little bit later on about how we can use machine learning as a classification tool. And linguistics as well. So I believe that we need some linguistic input into processing with language. Some people don't use very much linguistic input at all, but grammars, I think, are really important to be able to do advanced things. So that's a fraction of a bit of natural language grammar. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Okay, so I apply these tools to parsing. So that's grammatical analysis of text. That's an example of that first headline, Scott Stryker's In Fine Form. So there's an analysis, a syntactic or grammatical analysis of that sentence or that headline in terms of parts of speech, which are the little subscripts like N for noun, P for preposition, and so on. And then relationships between the words. So direct object, preposition object, modifier, and so on. So parsing is going from text to a syntactic structure that represents the grammar that's behind that text. I've also worked a lot on lexical acquisition. So that's learning information about words from raw text. So we can learn things like, for instance, the word lecture can take a prepositional object introduced by about or on or to. So I can lecture about something or on something or to somebody. Or I can lecture somebody about something or on something. So we can acquire information like that using parsing and some clever classification tools. We can also learn stuff about the meaning of words if we're a little bit more clever about what we do, and I'll give some examples of that a little bit later on. I also worked on generation, which you can almost think of as the opposite of parsing, although it isn't quite. It's going from a set of concepts or a thing that you want to express to text. So the opposite of parsing, which is text to meaning. So as a parsing algorithm sort of person, generation almost follows naturally because you revert, one thing you can do is reverse the way in which you write the program or the program works, so it just does the opposite. But I won't talk any more about that. And I've worked a lot on language processing applications. And I think it's great to get the basic technology right, so working on parsing, but there's no point in working on parsing if it's not producing the thing, anything that is really useful. So this is sort of a way of grounding the work that I'm doing, the basic science work, in something that's more technological and more applied. And I often work as part of large teams, so here's, I was involved in a European Union funded project about 20 years ago now. And that's a picture of the whole group there. Multinational, multilingual, multi-skilled group, linguists, computer scientists, application specialists. So that was 20 years ago, and this was taken a year ago. And this is a group that's working on a project which I'll talk about at the end of this talk on processing medical records. And again, it's multi-skilled, multidisciplinary. Okay, so that's the digital world, meaning, a very brief outline of my research. When I started writing this talk, I thought, well, what should I put in it? And there's a very wide range of possibilities. As Bob said, I've published widely and I've done a lot of things, a lot of different types of research. So again, as an empiricist, I thought, well, shall I get the data to tell me? So I took all my publication titles, all my paper titles, article titles, and I created a a word cloud from them. And one word stood out from that. I thought, well, I must talk about parsing. I wasn't actually going to. I wasn't planning to originally. So I wrote the abstract for this talk, and I don't think I mentioned parsing there particularly. But I just have to talk about it, so I will. And then there are other things in there. So I've just got to talk about evaluation, I think, and that's in the context of parsing. And I have to talk, I think, a little bit about acquisition over here. And I have to talk about disambiguation. And I think it's not particularly evident here, but I have to talk about sentiment, because I think that's a really interesting problem, even though it doesn't appear in big type here. And I have to talk about my latest project, because your latest project is always the thing that you're keenest on, even though it doesn't appear in any of these paper titles. So I'll do that as well. Okay, so parsing. So what is parsing? Well, if you're over a certain age, you might well have been taught how to parse foreign languages at school. So I learnt Latin, and I had to parse Latin. So in that sort of setup, you take a sentence, you analyse the words, find relationships between them, and that allows you to get at the meaning. In computer science, parsing has a technical meaning, which is taking a computer program and producing a syntax tree. And this is done by a compiler, automatically by the computer itself. And this, in this way, the computer can work out how to run the program. In computational linguistics, parsing is taking a sentence a string of text and producing a grammatical structure of the sort that I showed you a couple of slides ago. It's different from parsing in computer science because computer programs have a much more restricted range of expression, so the grammars for them are very small compared with natural languages, and they're not ambiguous, and it would be a disaster if your program was ambiguous, because then the computer wouldn't know what reading to take, because they wouldn't know how to compute with it. But as I said, language is very, very ambiguous, so that's the main, that's, well, those two things are the main difference between computer language parsing and natural language parsing. I've worked on parsing in the context of a number of systems. Actually, I've just mentioned two, but there are a couple of others that I haven't mentioned. RASP is a toolkit that I've developed with a number of others, most notably Ted Briscoe, and it's freely distributed for research purposes. And also the LKB, that's similar, but slightly different. The examples I'll give are in the context of RASP rather than the LKB. Okay, so just to give you a feeling of the ambiguity that you get when you parse, here's it's an old chestnut, it's a made-up sentence. And this sticks in my throat a little bit because I look at data and data isn't like this. You never see this sentence in data, but it does serve to show some of the problems that crop up and what happens when you try and parse. So time flies like an arrow. There are probably four interpretations of this. There's one that comes very naturally to most people, which is time flies, and it does this similarly to an arrow. So it goes in a straight line. Like that. But you can construct interpretations where you have the time sort of flies are keen on an arrow. Or two imperatives, you must time flies that are similar to an arrow, or you must time flies and do that timing similarly to an arrow. And they're quite difficult to get your head round. But a computer would find these. A computer does find these without any effort at all. So parsing partly is finding these interpretations and then choosing the right one. So how do we do that? Well, one of the areas I've worked on in parsing is dealing with this ambiguity and resolving it. And the contribution I've made is to construct models which are based on context. So an example of this might be that the probability of The first bit of that correct reading, so where time is flying, where the next word is like, that's more likely than the imperative reading where you're telling on someone to time flies, and with the next word being like. So the clever thing there is actually working out how to get these probability models right and then how to get them from data. So what sort of data do you need to be able to learn those probabilities accurately? So that's one thing I've done, one thing I worked on quite a long while ago now. Another thing I've worked on is better parsing algorithms. So algorithms that can deal with this ambiguity efficiently. So one thing I did was techniques for factoring out the representation during this processing so that we get phrases like an arrow, only computed once and only represented once, and the probability of that only computed once as well. So this involves some quite difficult algorithmic tricks to get it right. But when you get it right, it means that you can deal with language massively more efficiently than if you're doing things in the naive way, in the obvious way. And I also worked on evaluation. So how do we work out whether we're doing the right thing, whether we're getting the right analysis? So the idea is that there is a human identifies what the right analysis is, and then you compare what the computer is giving you to what the correct answer is. I and others have come up with an evaluation scheme where you look at the relationships, count the number of matching relationships that you get right. So maybe if this is the right answer, if you compare that with the right answer, then you're only getting one out of four of the relationships correctly. So your score is 25%. So those are some of the contributions I've made in parsing, and as I said, I wasn't going to really talk about them because this is sort of basic science and it doesn't really relate to any application task, except that parsing is, if you get parsing right, it can really help you do an application task, but it's really something that's under the hood, but immensely important. Okay. So the second thing I want to talk about is sentiment analysis. So this is about opinion. Some motivations for why we want to do things with opinion or sentiment. So brands and company image are valuable property, and companies want to know how they're viewed by the media, business analysts, their customers, and even their employees. So there's so much text out there, it's almost impossible to go through it manually. So if we could do this automatically, get the computer to look at the text and say to the company, yeah, you're being viewed favorably at the moment, or this news story that's just come out which puts you in an unfavorable light, you're gonna have to do something about this, then that's immensely valuable to them. So that's in the context of companies and organizations. People also want to know what the mood is out there. So is a product worth buying? So what do other people say about it? Is it worth going to a film? So what do the film reviews say about this film? Is it a good film? Will you like it? If you're buying stocks and shares, what's the market mood? So is this a good time to buy a particular share? And if people are saying, yes, this is a good one to buy at the moment, that probably means that they're buying it and the price is going to go up. So it might be a good idea if you did. Okay, so those are some motivations for looking at opinion. But it's an immensely slippery thing. Facts are difficult enough to extract from text. Opinions, are even more difficult. So here's an example of a subtlety, heavy read and weighty tone, pretty similar out of context, But if you're thinking about opinion, heavy read is a little bit negative. It implies that it's a difficult read, not what you're really looking for. Whereas weighty tome, well, if it's a reference book, you do definitely want a weighty tome because it's going to have everything in it. But there's a subtlety there which is going to be very difficult for a computer to pick up, but very important for working out what the opinion is. So we could use machine learning, and a lot of people have, particularly in early work in this area, to learn a classifier which takes a document and says, is this document broadly positive or is this document broadly negative? So is this review positive, is it negative, or is this newspaper report positive about a certain news story, or is it being shown in a negative light? But to be able to do that, people have found that it's critically dependent on having plenty of data, plenty of training data, to learn that that mapping from documents to classification decisions. And the data that you have has to be pretty much of the right topic, genre, and even time period to be applicable. So for instance, if we're thinking about films, then an unpredictable plot is quite good, usually. But if we're thinking about cars, unpredictable steering is bad. So unpredictable is not a word that, you can predict. It's you have to know what topic area you're in to know whether that's a good word or a bad word. In respect of genre, there's an example here. It's lovely working with language because you'll get to read all sorts of very weird stuff. So this is a very colourful film review of a film called, I think, Double Team. So it starts ripe with explosions, mass death, and really weird hairdos. Sui Hark's new film must be the result of a tipsy Hollywood power lunch. Now, that's very different from newspaper text, which is sober and factual, but still often has opinion in. And if we're learning stuff about explosions, mass death, weird hairdos, those sorts of words aren't likely to be part of an editorial or opinion piece in a newspaper. So we need to have a match in terms of genre as well. And time period even. So I've got a picture of an ice axe here. And one of my students was doing an experiment on automatically finding sentiment in film reviews. And in his data were a lot of reviews about the film Touching the Void, which is about climbing, and a climber ends up down a crevasse and has to use an ice axe very creatively to get out or whatever. And everyone liked the film, and everyone mentioned the word ice axe, or the phrase ice axe. So the computer would think that ice axe was a positive feature. But of course, that's complete rubbish. Ice axe is completely incidental to opinion. It just correlates very well with opinion about films in that time period. And we want to get away from that. It's going to cause us problems if we learn things like that. Okay, so I've had two or three students working on this problem, looking at different aspects of it. I also did some applied research with a colleague of mine, Phil Husbands, where we were doing a contract for a company, and we got tripped up by this problem, I think, that we ended up with a classifier that was too tightly tuned to the data. So in machine learning, what you want to do, sort of in very broad terms, is to take a set of data points and map them in this case I've represented it as a two-dimensional space, such that you can draw a line between two sets of data points and say ones on one side of the line have one type of classification, ones on the other side of the line have the other classification. And you do that by sort of computing a transformation effectively from a large feature space. So this is a feature vector, perhaps containing just counts of words in the documents that you're processing, and a map between that feature vector and the space, and work out what the line has to be. And basically what goes wrong when you have the wrong type of data is that you learn a line which works well with the training data, but actually for the data you're processing, the line should be in a different place. And we did some, we had two sets of training data produced for us by this company, and we were in competition with another team. And we did very well on one set of data, much better than the other team, but they beat us soundly on another set of data because we were what's called overfitting, whereas they were sort of generalizing from the data quite nicely. So what we want to do is to sort of get away from that overfitting, get away from the ISACS effect, try and get away from the very tight tie-in with genre and topic. And some smart ways of doing that are to use more data, and use data which perhaps hasn't been annotated according to the type of thing that you want to learn. So one of my students has been learning prototypical topic sentiment vocabulary lists in quite a clever way from text which hasn't, which you really don't know whether it's positive or negative, by the observation that words that behave similarly to good are also probably positive words. So he's doing this in Chinese, and here's an example on a set of product review, it's on a product review website in Chinese, looking at computer monitors. And words that behave similarly to good are convenient and cheap, clear, straight, comfortable. I think this is about fulfilling an order well, sharp, comfortable, and cool. So this is learning from the data in a very clever way by just saying, well, what words behave similarly to good? Those are probably good words, positive words. Okay, I think that's probably enough about sentiment. I had prepared another slide, but I think I'll skip on from that. Okay, so the third and final topic I want to talk to you about, my latest project, Jackie Cassell is here. She's one of my co-investigators. Mining text in electronic patient records. So we all know that when we go to a GP surgery, the GP has a computer in front of him or her, and they type things at this computer. It's a bit different in other countries, but we're very fortunate in the UK that all GP surgeries are computerized. And it's done quite well. So the GP can enter codes, and they can type in text. So the codes might code what symptoms that you're reporting, or what is the outcome of certain examinations that they do while you're there in the surgery. There are also codes about what you've been prescribed, what treatments you're on, and so on. A very nice thing is that records are collected centrally from a lot of surgeries, or I think about 10% of surgeries in the country, and held in large databases. And those records, suitably anonymized, so that researchers, people looking at that data, don't know about individual people. They're used for drug safety monitoring, disease surveillance, and health services research, or epidemiology. So these records contain codes, as I said. They also contain what the doctors typed. And it turns out that there's a lot of information in that, the stuff that the doctors type, that isn't coded. And it's very useful information for doing research on. So that information could allow us to do earlier diagnosis. If we can look for patterns of symptoms that the GP might not have sort of connected together, because maybe it's a rare disease, or it could allow us to more reliably identify individuals with certain diseases, perhaps diseases which GPs are unwilling to code because they carry a stigma. So what we want to do, and what we do, well, what we're doing in this project, is to mine that textual information. But it's very noisy stuff. And some of the text I've looked at, it's been anonymized, but it looks as though sort of the proverbial monkeys and typewriters have been at it. It's much worse actually than this, what's up here. And this is bad enough for the layperson to understand. So I'll try and explain it actually. I've had it explained to me, and I'll see if I can reproduce that explanation. So the code is complains of a pain, and the GP has run their record sort of straight on after that. So complains of a pain, back and legs and abdomen. They've typed in equals here, and it probably maybe should be a dash to separate the next bit of information. Loss of appetite and heaving, and G and H are next together on the keyboard, so they've typed them both together. Tattoo, that's nothing to do with having a tattoo, as you might think. It's tat is tied all the time, two. Wind, two, no altered bowel habit, and N and B are next to each other on the keyboard. No blood per rectum. So that's what the patient is reporting. And OE is on examination. Angular stomatitis, looks unwell. Abdomen, I don't know why that's there. Possible swelling right side. They've done a rectal examination, I think. Possible swelling right side marginal, I think. Per rectum, okay. So that examination's okay. Haven't a clue about the diagnosis. Perhaps diverticulitis, which is misspelt. The patient needs their bloods done and a review in a week's time. So there's a lot of information in here, but it really needs to be decoded. And I probably haven't done it right, but anyway, it's something like that. So you can see there's lots of challenging problems here in trying to process this automatically. There's a wide variety of means of expression. So we've got idiosyncratic expressions here. A lot of them be understood by all GPs, but some might be idiosyncratic to individual GPs. And symptoms can be described in very many different ways. We haven't got any full sentences here. Very few discourse connectives, so no buts, ands, because, therefore, and so on. Lots of abbreviations, typos, missing punctuation, inconsistent spacing, and so on. Negation is usually very important, and punctuation, so question mark is a very important character, and not, nil, no, and so on are very important as well. And as I said, before we can see this text, it has to be manually anonymized, and that's very expensive. That has to be done centrally at where the records are stored. And if you want to do research on those records, you have to pay for that anonymization at something like 5p per word. But if you want a significant amount of data, that gets, well, it rapidly adds up and gets expensive. So there's all sorts of problems with as a researcher of getting this text and processing it. But we've done some preliminary experiments in the context of this project, which is called PREP, Patient Records Enhancement Project. So just some preliminary experiments to see, well, can we leverage some of this text that we have in ways which would allow us to get more information out than just the coded information, which is well, it's difficult to deal with, but relatively simple compared with the text. So our One of our diseases of interest is ovarian cancer, and there's a collection of symptoms which can be indicative of ovarian cancer. So we're looking for five sort of common symptoms which may be a precursor to or show that a woman is in early stages of ovarian cancer. So diarrhea, constipation, abdominal distension, urogenital problem, abdominal pain. Some of these are coded. So that's the red. And we can get some information about which records have those complaints identified in codes. But we can also look at the text automatically and do some automatic matching against the descriptions of those codes, so that those are bits of text, fragments of text, that we can do some fuzzy matching on, basically. And it turns out, you can see here from the green, that we can get information, sometimes more information from the free text than we can from the codes. And if we combine codes and free text, which is the blue bars, we could identify significantly more records of interest than just using codes on their own. So there's quite a bit of mileage here to be had from texts. We know that now. Okay, so we've looked at the results, and there are very few false positives, so there are very few cases where we've misidentified a bit of text as having a symptom, whereas it actually doesn't express a symptom. But we know we're missing quite a lot. So here's an example. Well, this is the same example, and I've marked it up with things that we should be able to find, or we'd like to be able to find, but most of these are quite difficult. For tiredness, we know that we have to know that TATT is an indicator of tiredness. That wind is a way of expressing indigestion or flatulence. Swelling R side is a way of expressing abdominal distension. So you can see we're quite a long way from this phrase, abdominal distension, to swelling right side. So ideally, we'd like to be able to automatically sort of get synonyms of abdominal distension, or some way of getting a mapping from that to swelling on a particular side of the body or the abdomen. One thing we're looking at, one technique that we're looking at the moment to do this is called creating a distributional thesaurus. So basically what we're trying to do is find words which are used in very similar contexts. And if one word is used in a similar context to another, it probably means that their meaning is related to each other. So I've done a little bit of example here with the word abdominal. So looked at the words on either side of abdominal in a few of these patient records. Either side of abdomen and either side of abdo. And I mean, this is a bit of a cheat because I know these words are very similar, but the computer wouldn't. The computer doesn't, or doesn't necessarily. But if you look at these contexts, you'll see that they share a lot of words. So at least these words that I've listed here: distended, exam, growing, hard, left, lower, and so on. So if we've got a long list of words which are in a shared context between two different words, we can assume that those words have some meaning component in common. Sometimes they're synonyms, sometimes they're near synonyms, other times they might be antonyms, or opposites of each other, and we'd have to sort of take care of that somehow. But certainly if we run our algorithms on those examples, what we're looking for is what I've just described is second order similarity. We find that the computer would find that abdominal is similar to abdomen, is similar to abdo. Here's some more difficult examples. So we found that concern is very similar to problem and issue. That's good. Sec is similar to doctor, physician, registrar, and sec stands for secretary. So we've learnt that these are types of people who do have a certain role in a hospital. PT is a patient, that's a very common abbreviation. CREP is similar to crackle. And I think CREP is a sort of crackle in the chest, is that right? It's short for crepitation? Yeah. I didn't know that, but the computer's found it. Edema is a swelling, swelling caused by fluid, I think. And a stent is very similar to a catheter in the way that you sort of push it into the body. Won't go there. the computer has found some quite interesting groups of words that have very similar meaning components. And we can cluster these. So here's a little bit of an example of a clustering of words which have similar contexts. So we've got registrar, gentleman, consultant, so people. We've got symptom, complaint, problem, concern. So these are things that the patient is reporting. And we've got types of things that go wrong, occlusion, aneurysm, dysfunction, infarction, and so on. We've got stuff to do with the heart up here. This is indicative that we're getting somewhere, but we're only halfway through the project and I haven't got any solid results to report. But this is the sort of way we go about dealing with problems. We do a rough initial study, work out what's going wrong, where we need to improve the system, and then work on a technique which will allow us to tackle those issues that we found. Okay, so I'll wrap up. I've talked about the digital world. I've talked about meaning or components of meaning that we'd like to get out of text and that can be useful for applications. I've talked about a basic technology, parsing. I've talked a bit about sentiment analysis, so mining opinion in text. And I've talked about mining text in electronic patient records, looking for symptoms. I'm co-director of a company called iLexia, so that's a little plug for the company. And as part of the company work, we've used particularly the parsing work to develop nice applications which are making money for other companies and also making money for our company because we get license income. So one nice application is automated assessment of exam scripts. So the computer reads an essay and marks it. And this is foreign language learners of English. So all they have to do is to write something which is grammatical. It needn't necessarily be very coherent. And we can mark that. We can get the computer to mark that quite reliably, as reliably as humans. SMS question answering. So analysing text messages, working out what they're asking about, and if it's a directory inquiry, then producing an answer automatically. Anonymising text in sensitive documents, so that relates to the medical records work, actually. And extracting knowledge from biomedical articles, so automatically finding information like protein-gene interactions from what the scientists are reporting in their scientific papers. These are some real applications. I haven't talked in any detail about these, but if you go to our website, iLexia.com, you'll find a little bit more about those. So this science and technology does feed into practical applications, and I'm really excited about these types of applications and getting the science out there into the real world. And finally, I want to thank all my collaborators and colleagues over the years for all their input. And this is probably an incomplete list, but I tried to make it as complete as I could. There's about 80 names there. And many thanks to all of them and to any I inadvertently left off. So thank you very much.